This episode was created with the support of Free FM, Hamilton, New Zealand's community access media organisation. Visit us at freefm.org.nz.
Greetings, I am Barry. If you're searching for answers, spiritual help, clairvoyant readings, healings, crystals, books, incense, or jewellery, you need to go to Infinity, Hamilton Spiritual Centre, in the new premises at 550 Anglesey Street. Or you can phone us on 838 1838. This is your link between this life and the next. Become the change the world needs today.
Can you hear me? Can you hear me, Ronnie? Can you hear me, Ronnie? Can you hear me calling you? Can you hear me? Can you hear me, Ronnie? Can you hear me, Ronnie? Can you hear me calling you?
The Voice Within, your connection between this world and the next. Brought to you by Infinity Spiritual Center, 550 Anglesey Street, Hamilton.
Greetings, I am Barry. So we continue with our epic of Marcel de Marquet. This is part 5 called Living on a New Planet.
Learning to live on another planet. It seemed that Val was also very popular here, and she found herself answering numerous questions, always with her natural, broad smile. Before long, however, several of our hosts were required to resume their duties, and we took this as our cue to leave. My mask was put on again, and we left these people, as well as those in the larger room, amidst many gestures of friendship and goodwill. We rejoined our vehicle and immediately accelerated away in the direction of a forest, which could be seen in the distance. We flew at a height of approximately 5 or 6 meters and at a speed I would have estimated to be 70 or 80 kilometers per hour. The air was warm and fragrant, and I again felt euphoric, in a way I had never experienced on Earth. We arrived at the edge of the forest, and I remember having been greatly impressed by the size of the largest trees. They looked to rise about 200 meters into the sky. The tallest is 240 of your meters, Michelle. Thou explained without me having to ask, and between 20 and 30 meters in diameter at the base. Some of these are 8,000 of our years old. Our year consists of 333 days of 26 karses. A karse is a period of 55 lors, a lors comprising 70 kasios, and a kasio being almost equivalent to one of your seconds. Now there's a sum for you. Would you like to go to your apartment, or to have a look at the forest first? Let's visit the forest first, thou. The vehicle greatly reduced its speed, and we were able to glide between, or indeed, stop and observe more closely, the trees at heights that ranged from almost ground level to 10 meters above the ground. Thou was able to guide our flying platform with amazing precision and expertise. Our vehicle, and Thou's manner of driving it, put me in mind of a flying carpet, which was taking me on a magical tour of this magnificent forest floor. Thou leaned towards me and removed my mask. The undergrowth was luminous and softly golden, but I found it quite tolerable. It is a good time to begin accustoming yourself to the light and color, Michelle. Look, following her gaze, I spotted, very high among the branches, 3 butterflies, vividly colored and of enormous size. These Lepidoptera, which must have had 1 meter wingspans, fluttered high in the foliage, but we were lucky to see them fly closer and closer to us, on wings of blue, green and orange. It is as clear to me as if it were yesterday. They brushed against us with their wings that were strangely fringed, to create the most beautiful and breathtaking effect. One of them came to rest on a leaf just a few meters from us, and I was able to admire its body, ringed with silver and gold, and its jade-green antennae. Its proboscis was golden and the tops of its wings were green with streaks of bright blue alternated with dark orange diamond shapes. The undersides were dark blue, but luminous, as though they had been illuminated from above by a projector. For the duration of time this giant insect remained on the leaf, it seemed to emit a soft whistling sound, and I was quite surprised by this. I had certainly not heard a lepidopteran on Earth make any sound at all. Of course, we were no longer on Earth but on Theuba, and this was only the beginning of a long series of surprises for me. On the forest floor grew an incredible variety of plants, each one stranger than the next. They covered the ground completely, but I noticed very few bushes among them. I imagine the forest's giants prevented them from developing. In size, these plants varied from a ground-covering moss-like plant to one the size of a large rose bush. One kind, with leaves as thick as a hand in various shapes, sometimes heart-shaped or circular, sometimes very long and thin, was of a color tending much more towards blue than to green. Flowers of every shape and color, even of the purest black, entwined each other. From our altitude of several meters, the effect was absolutely glorious. We rose till we were up among the highest branches, and I put my mask back on according to Thao's direction. We emerged from the canopy and moved slowly, just above the foliage of those enormous trees. Above the forest the light was, once again, incredibly intense, and I had the impression of traveling through a landscape of pure crystal. Marvelous birds were perched on the tops of the taller trees, watching us pass, without fear. Their colors, varied and rich, were a veritable feast for my eyes in spite of the subduing effect of my mask. Here were varieties of macaw, with blue, yellow, pink and red plumage, and, among them a type of bird of paradise strutted amidst a cloud of what appeared to be hummingbirds. These hummingbirds were of a brilliant red color flecked with gold. The red, pink and orange tail feathers of the birds of paradise would have measured 250 centimeters in length and their wingspans almost 2 meters. When these jewels took flight, the underside of their wings revealed a very soft, misty pink, with just a touch of bright blue on the tips. So unexpected, especially as the tops of their wings were of an orange-yellow color. Their heads wore plumes of impressive size, each feather being a different color: yellow, green, orange, black, blue, red, white, cream. I feel frustrated that my attempts to describe the colors I saw on Theuba are so inadequate. I feel I need a whole new lexicon, as my language fails me. I had the constant impression that the colors came from within the objects I looked at, and the color was more than I had known it to be. On Earth, we know perhaps 15 shades of red. Here there must have been over 100. It wasn't only the colors that claimed my attention. The sounds that I had heard since we began to fly over the forest inspired me to seek an explanation from Thao. It was almost a background music, very light and soft, similar to a flute which continually played the same air but at a distance. As we moved on, the music seemed to change, only to return to the original tune. Is that music I hear? It is vibrations emitted by the thousands of insects which, when combined with the vibrations of the colors reflected by solar rays onto certain plants, such as the Zinnixia, for example, produce the very musical results that you hear. We, ourselves, only hear it if we particularly attune to it, for it comprises an integral part of our life and our environment. It is restful, isn't it? Absolutely. According to the experts, if these vibrations were to cease, we would experience considerable eye trouble. This will perhaps seem odd at first, since these vibrations appear to be perceptible to the ear rather than the eye. However, experts are experts, Michel, and, in any case, it is of little concern to us, for they also say that the chance of their ceasing is as remote as the chance of our sun extinguishing itself tomorrow. Thou turned our vehicle, and in a few moments, we had left the forest tops and were flying over a plain, across which flowed a jade-green river. We descended to an altitude of about 3 meters and followed its course. Now we were able to follow the movements of strange fish, fish that resembled platypuses more than fish, as I knew them to be. The water was pure, like crystal, and at this altitude we could distinguish everything down to the smallest pebble. Looking up, I saw we were approaching the ocean. Palm trees resembling coconut palms waved their majestic fronds at impressive heights, on the edge of a beach of golden sands. The blue of the ocean contrasted pleasantly with the bright red of rocks encrusted in small hills, which overlooked a section of its beach. 100 or so people basked on the sand or swam, entirely naked, in the transparent waters of the ocean. I felt a little dazed, not only because of the new and wondrous things I was constantly discovering, but also because of the perpetual sensation of lightness, due to the change in gravity. This sensation was my reminder of Earth. What a strange word, and how difficult it was to visualize Earth now. The auditory and visual vibrations were also affecting my nervous system enormously. Usually a highly strung person, I was feeling completely relaxed, as if I had plunged into a warm bath, allowing myself to float in the bubbles while soft music played. No, even more relaxed than that, so relaxed I felt like crying. We proceeded, quite rapidly, across the waters of the immense bay, flying about 12 meters above the waves. On the horizon, I could distinguish several dots, some larger than others, and I realized these were islands, no doubt those I had seen prior to our landing on Theuba. As we headed for the smallest island, I looked below and saw that we were being followed by numerous fish, amusing themselves by criss-crossing the shadow our vehicle projected on the water. "Are they sharks?" I asked. "No, they're Dajiks, the brothers of your dolphin. You see, they are as fond of playing as your dolphins are. Look," I interrupted Thou. "Look." Thou looked to where I was pointing and began laughing. I was astonished to see a group of people approaching us, seemingly without the aid of a vehicle. They were about 2 meters above the water, in a vertical position, and not only floating in the air, but moving quite rapidly towards us. Soon our paths crossed and grand gestures of friendship were exchanged. At the same instant, a wave of well-being flowed through me, lasting several seconds. It was the same sensation Latoli had produced, and I recognized it as a sign of greeting from these flying people. "How do they do that? Is it levitation?" "No, they have a tara on their waists and a lidiolac in their hands. These produce certain vibrations that neutralize the cold magnetic force of the planet, allowing neutralization of the gravitational force. Even a weight of millions of tons compares with that of feathers. Then, by other vibrations resembling those of ultrasound, they can steer themselves precisely to wherever they choose, as they are doing now. On this planet, everyone wanting to travel some distance uses this method." "Then why are we using this vehicle?" I asked, for I would have loved to experiment with such equipment, which, by the way, was absolutely noiseless. "Michel, you are impatient. I have brought you by this means because you are not capable of flying with a lidiolac. Without practice, you could hurt yourself. Later, perhaps, if there is time, I will teach you how to use it. Look, we are nearly there. Indeed, we were fast approaching an island and could clearly see a golden beach where several people basked in the sun. Almost immediately, we were flying beneath palm fronds along a wide path, bordered with two rows of flowering and very fragrant bushes. The area was alive with the sound and color of insects, butterflies and birds. The vehicle proceeded slowly at ground level and, after a final bend in the path, we arrived before a little egg, nestled among small trees and flowering vines. It seemed that every building on this planet had the shape of an egg, most often lying on their sides, but occasionally upright, as I have said, with the pointed end upwards. The shells were off-white in color and had no windows or doors. This particular egg lay on its side, apparently half buried in the ground. It was about 30 meters long and 20 meters in diameter, quite small in comparison with those I'd seen so far. Thou stopped the vehicle in front of a bright light centered on the wall of the egg. Leaving the platform, we entered the habitation. As we did so, I felt a light pressure, with no more force than the weight of an eiderdown. I remembered experiencing the same sensation earlier, when we passed through the wall of the space center. Having neither doors nor windows on these buildings is extraordinary in itself, but once inside, it was stranger still. As I have mentioned before, the overall impression was of still being outside. The startling beauty of color was everywhere, the greenery, the branches of the trees dissecting the blue mauve sky above, the butterflies, the flowers. I recall a bird that came to rest right in the middle of the roof, so that we could see the bottom of its feet. It was as though it had miraculously stopped in midair. The effect was quite extraordinary. The only contrast with the outside was provided by the floor that was covered in a type of carpet on which were arranged comfortable-looking seats and large pedestal tables. All of these furnishings were, of course, on a large scale, appropriate to the Seven Masters and the Aura. A huge flame burned blue, orange, yellow, and red flames burned around it. An enormous black snake slid straight through the flames, heading for me. Giants appeared from nowhere, running and trying to catch the snake. It took seven of them together to stop it before it reached me. But it turned and swallowed the flames, only to spit them back out, like a dragon, at the giants. They were transformed into immense statues just as they were, mounted on the tail of the snake. The reptile became a comet and carried the statues off to Easter Island. Next, they were greeting me, wearing strange hats. One of the statues, resembling Thou, caught me by the shoulder and said, "Michel, Michel, wake up." Thou was shaking me and gently smiling. "My goodness," I said, opening my eyes, "I was dreaming you were an Easter Island statue and that you caught hold of me by the shoulder." "I am an Easter Island statue, and I did take you by the shoulder. Anyway, I'm not dreaming now, am I?" "No, but your dream was really quite strange, for on Easter Island, there is a statue which was sculptured a very long time ago to immortalize me and which was given my name." "What are you telling me now?" "The simple truth, Michel, but we will explain all that to you in good time. For now, we will try on these clothes I've brought for you." Thou handed me a richly colored robe which quite delighted me and, after a warm and perfumed bath, I dressed in the garment. A feeling of euphoria, which was totally unexpected, overwhelmed me. I mentioned it to Thou, who was waiting with a glass of milk and a little manna for me. "The colors of your robe were chosen according to those of your aura, that's why you feel so good. If people on Earth were able to see auras, they too could choose colors, which suit them and thereby enhance their feeling of well-being. They make use of color rather than aspirin. What do you mean, exactly? I'll give you an example. Do you ever remember saying of someone, "Oh, those clothes don't suit you at all. He or she has no taste." Yes, quite often, in fact. Well, in such cases, those people have simply chosen their clothes less skillfully than others, or mixed them less successfully. As you say in French, they jurent or clash, but more in the eyes of others than in their own. However, such people will not feel good in themselves, without realizing why. If you were to suggest it be because of the colors they were wearing, they would think you odd. You could explain that the vibrations of the colors were in discord with those of their auras, but they would be no more inclined to believe you. On your planet, people only believe in what they see or touch, and yet the aura can be seen. The aura is actually colored? Of course. The aura vibrates constantly with colors that vary. At the top of your head is a veritable bouquet of colors, where almost all the colors you know are represented. Around the head, too, is a golden halo, but it is only really obvious in the most highly spiritual people and in those who have sacrificed themselves in order to help someone else. The halo resembles a golden mist, much like painters on earth depict the halos of saints and of Christ. The halos were included in their paintings because, in those times, some of the artists actually saw them. Yes, I have heard mention of that, but I love to hear it from you. The colors are all there in the aura. Some shine more strongly, others are dull. People in poor health, for example, or people with bad intentions. I would like so much to see the aura. I know there are people who can see it. Many people on Earth could see it and read it a very long time ago, but there are few now. Calm yourself, Michel. You will see it, and not only one but several, including your own. Now, though, I'll ask you to follow me, because we have so much to show you and little time available. I followed Thao, who placed my mask on my face and led the way to the flying platform we had used the day before. We took our places and immediately Thao began maneuvering the machine so that it dodged below the branches of trees. In a matter of moments, we had emerged on the beach. The sun had just risen behind the island and lit up the ocean and surrounding islands. From water level, the effect was magical. As we proceeded along the beach, I could see other docos through the foliage, nestled among flowering bushes. On the beach, the inhabitants of these dwellings bathed in transparent waters or strolled together on the sand. Apparently surprised to see our flying platform, they followed our progress as we passed. It occurred to me that this was not the usual means of transport on the island. I should mention too, although swimmers and sunbathers are always completely naked on Theuba, those who stroll or move any significant distance, always dress to do so. On this planet, there is neither hypocrisy, exhibitionism nor false modesty. This will be explained later. It was not long before we reached the end of the island and, accelerating, Thao guided the vehicle at water level. We headed in the direction of a large island, which could be seen on the horizon. I could not help but admire the dexterity with which Thao piloted the flying machine, especially when we arrived at the shore of the island. Approaching the coast, I could recognize enormous docos, their points as usual towards the sky. I counted a group of 9, but the island was sprinkled with others, smaller and less visible amongst the vegetation. Thao took us higher and we were soon flying over what Thao called Kotra Kuo Doj Doko, the city of the 9 docos. Skillfully, Thao brought us down between the docos, to a beautiful park located in their midst. In spite of my mask, I was aware that the golden mist that enveloped Theuba was much denser around these docos than elsewhere. Thou confirmed I was not mistaken in my perception, but she was not then able to explain the phenomenon, as they were waiting for us. She led me beneath an archway of greenery and along a path, which ran beside small ponds. Here wonderful water birds frolicked and little waterfalls murmured. I found myself almost running to keep up with Thou, but didn't like to ask her to slow down. She appeared preoccupied in a way that was not typical of her. At one point, there was almost a catastrophe when I tried to jump, as much to amuse myself as to catch up with Thou. Due to the difference in gravity, I misjudged my leap and had to catch hold of a tree, which grew right on the water's edge, to prevent myself from falling in. Eventually, we reached the central doko and stopped below the entrance light. Thou seemed to concentrate for several seconds, then she took me by the shoulder and we passed through the wall. She immediately removed my mask, advising at the same time that I half closed my eyes, which I did. Light filtered through my lower lids and after a time, I was able to open my eyes normally. I must say that this brightness, more golden than in my own doko, was considerably uncomfortable at first. I was most curious now, especially since Thou, who was usually very free and without protocol in her relations with everyone, seemed to have abruptly changed in her manner. Why? This doko must have been 100 meters in diameter. We headed directly, although more slowly, for the center, where 7 seats, each occupied, were arranged in a semicircle. The occupants sat as though petrified and, at first, I thought them to be statues. In looks they resembled Thou, although their hair was longer and their facial expressions more serious, giving them the air of being older. Their eyes seemed to be illuminated from within, which was somewhat disturbing. What struck me most of all was the golden haze, even stronger here than outside, which seemed to concentrate in halos around their heads. Since the age of 15, I don't recall ever having been in awe of another person. No matter how grand a personage, no matter how important he or she was, or thought they were, I have not felt intimidated by position. Neither have I had qualms about expressing my opinion to anyone. To me, the president of a nation is still just a person and it amuses me that people regard themselves as VIPs. I mention this to make it clear I am not impressed by mere status. In the doko, all that changed. When one of them raised a hand to indicate Thou and I should each take a seat facing them, I was indeed awestruck, and the word is feeble. I could not have imagined it possible that such radiant beings could exist. It was as though they were on fire inside and emitting rays from within. They sat on block-like seats, fabric-covered, with straight backs. Each seat was of a different color, some only slightly different and others vastly different from their neighbors. Their clothes, too, differed in color, suiting each wearer perfectly. All of them sat in what we call on earth, the lotus position, that is, the sitting position of Buddha, with hands resting on knees. As previously mentioned, they formed a semicircle and, since there were 7 of them, I reasoned that the central figure had to be the principal one, with 3 acolytes on either side. Of course, at the time, I was too overcome to note such details. It only occurred to me later. It was the central figure who addressed me, in a voice so melodious and, at the same time, so authoritarian. I was stunned by it, particularly since he spoke in perfect French. You are welcome among us, Michel. May the Spirit assist and enlighten you. The others echoed, May the Spirit enlighten you. He began to rise gently above his seat, still in the lotus position, and floated towards me. This did not entirely surprise me since Thou had previously demonstrated this technique of levitation. I wanted to rise before this undoubtedly great and highly spiritual personage, as a measure of the infinite respect inspired in me. In trying to move, I found I couldn't, as though paralyzed in my seat. He stopped just above and in front of me, placing both his hands on my head, the thumbs joined on my forehead above my nose, opposite the pineal gland, and the fingers joined at the top of my head. It was Thao who described these details to me later, for at the time, I was overwhelmed by such a sensation that the details didn't register. During the time his hands were on my head, it seemed that my body no longer existed. A gentle warmth and delicate perfume originated within me, emanating in waves and blending with soft music that was barely audible. Suddenly, I could see amazing colors surrounding the figures opposite me and, as the leader returned slowly towards his seat, I could see a multitude of radiant colors around him, ones I had been unable to perceive before. The principal color was a mass of pale pink which enveloped the seven figures, as though in a cloud, and their movements caused that wonderful, glowing pink to encircle us also. When I had sufficiently recovered my senses to turn towards Thao, she too was surrounded with wonderful colors, although less brilliant than those around the seven figures. You will notice that, in speaking of these great personages, I instinctively use he rather than she. In explaining this, I can only suggest that the personalities of these special beings were so strong and their bearings so imposing, that I recognized more of the masculine in them than the feminine. I mean no offense to women, my reaction was instinctive. It's a bit like imagining Methuselah as a woman. However, women or men, they had transformed me. I knew that the colors surrounding them were their auras. I was capable of seeing auras, who knew for how long, and I wondered at what I saw. The leader had resumed his seat and all eyes were fixed on me, as if they wanted to see inside me, which indeed is what they were doing. Silence reigned for a time, which seemed interminable. I watched the varied colors of their auras vibrate and dance around them, sometimes far in the distance, and recognized the bouquet of color Thao had spoken of earlier. The golden halos, clearly defined, were almost saffron-colored. It occurred to me they could not only see my aura, but possibly read it as well. I suddenly felt quite naked before this learned assembly. The question that haunted me was, why have they brought me here? Abruptly, the leader broke the silence. As Thao has already explained to you, Michelle, you have been chosen by us to visit our planet, in order to report certain messages and to offer enlightenment on several important issues when you return to Earth. The time has come when certain events must occur. After several thousand years of darkness and savagery on the planet Earth, a so-called civilization appeared and, inevitably, technology was developed, a development which was accelerated during the last 150 years. It has been 14,500 years since a comparable level of technological advance existed on Earth. This technology, which is nothing compared with true knowledge, is nevertheless sufficiently advanced to become harmful to the human race on Earth in the very near future. Harmful, because it is only material knowledge and not spiritual knowledge. Technology should assist spiritual development, not confine people, more and more, within a materialistic world, as is happening now on your planet. To an even greater extent, your people are obsessed with a single goal, affluence. Their lives are concerned with all that the pursuit of wealth entails: envy, jealousy, hatred of those richer, and contempt for those poorer. In other words, your technology, which is nothing compared with what existed on Earth more than 14,500 years ago, is dragging your civilization down, and pushing it closer and closer to moral and spiritual catastrophe. I noticed that each time this great personage spoke of materialism, his aura and those of his acolytes flashed with a dull and dirty red, as though momentarily they were in the middle of burning bushes. We, the people of Theuba, are assigned to assist, guide and sometimes punish the inhabitants of planets under our guardianship. Fortunately, thou had briefed me on Earth's history during our journey to Theuba. Otherwise, I'd have surely fallen off my seat on hearing such a speech. I think, he resumed, that you already know what we mean by harmful to the human race. Many people on Earth believe atomic arms to be the major danger, but it is not so. The greatest danger concerns materialism. The people of your planet seek money. To some it's a means of attaining power. To others it's a means to acquire drugs, another curse. Yet to others, it's a way of possessing more than their neighbors possess. If a businessman owns a large store, he then wants a second, then a third. If he commands a small empire, he wants to increase it. If an ordinary man owns a house in which he could live happily with his family, he wants a larger one or to own a second one, then a third. Why this folly? Besides, a man will die and have to abandon all he has amassed. Perhaps his children will squander his legacy and his grandchildren will live in poverty? His whole life will have been preoccupied with purely material concerns, with insufficient time allowed for matters of the spirit. Others with money turn to drugs in their endeavor to procure an artificial paradise, and these people pay more dearly than do the others. I see, he continued. I am going much too fast and you are not following me, Michel. You should be able to follow, however, since thou has already initiated your education in these matters during your voyage. I felt ashamed, almost like when reprimanded by a teacher at school. The only difference being, here I was not able to cheat by saying I had understood when it wasn't true. He could read me like an open book. He deigned to smile at me and his aura, which had been flaming like a fire, returned to its original hue. Now, once and for always, we will teach you and provide you with what you French call the key to the mystery. As you have heard, in the beginning there was the spirit alone, and he created, by his immense force, all that exists materially. He created the planets, the suns, plants, animals, with one goal in mind, to satisfy his spiritual need. This is quite logical since he is purely spirit. Already I see you are wondering why the need to create material things in order to attain spiritual fulfillment. I offer this, by way of explanation. The Creator sought spiritual experiences through a material world. I see you still have difficulty following, but you are making progress. In order to have these experiences, he wanted to embody a tiny part of his spirit in a physical entity. To do this, he called on the fourth force, the force which thou has not yet spoken of and which concerns only spirituality. In this domain, universal law also applies. You most certainly know that the pattern of the universe dictates that nine planets revolve around their sun. It is also the case that these suns revolve around a bigger sun, which is the nucleus for nine such suns and their nine planets. So it continues, right to the center of the universe from where the explosion referred to by the English as the Big Bang originated. Needless to say, certain accidents occur and sometimes a planet will disappear in a solar system, or perhaps enter it, but later in time, the solar system will revert and base its structure again on the number nine. The fourth force had a very important role to play. It had to bring to fruition all that the spirit had imagined. It inserted, thus, an infinitesimal part of the spirit in the human body. This comprises what you could call the astral body, which forms 1/9 of the essential human being and consists of 1/9 of a higher self, which is sometimes called overself. The higher self of man is, in other words, an entity which sends 1/9 of itself into a human body, becoming the person's astral being. Other physical bodies are inhabited, similarly, by other 1/9 of the same higher self, and yet each part remains integral to the central entity. Further, the higher self is a 1/9 part of a superior higher self which, in turn, is a 1/9 part of a more superior higher self. The process continues as far back as the source, and allows the enormous filtration of spiritual experience required by the spirit. You must not think that the higher self of the first category is insignificant in comparison with the others. It functions at a lower level, but is nevertheless extremely powerful and important. It is capable of curing illness and even resuscitating the dead. There are many instances of people, declared clinically dead, who are brought back to life in the hands of doctors who had abandoned all hope for them. What generally happens in these cases is that the person's astral body meets with the higher self. This portion of the higher self has left the physical body during the period of death. It perceives its physical body below and the doctors trying to resuscitate it. It can also perceive loved ones who mourn for it. In his present state, the astral body, the person will feel perfectly well, even blissful. Usually he abandons his physical body, frequently the source of much suffering, to find himself catapulted down a psychic canal, at the end of which is a wondrous light and beyond, a state of bliss. If before passing through this canal into the blissful light which is his higher self he has the least will not to die, not on his own account but for the sake of those who need him, young children for example, he will ask to return. In certain cases it will be permitted. You are in constant communication with your higher self by means of your cerebral canal. Acting as a transmitting and receiving post, it conducts special vibrations directly between your astral body and your higher self. Your higher self monitors you continually, by day and by night, and can intervene to save you from an accident. Someone, for example, who is to catch a plane, finds that the taxi breaks down on the way to the airport. A second taxi called also breaks down, just like that. Just like that? Could you really believe in such a coincidence? The plane in question crashes 30 minutes later, leaving no survivors. Another person, an old and rheumatic woman and barely able to walk, starts to cross a street. There is a loud horn blast and a screeching of tires, but this person is miraculously able to leap to safety. How is this explained? It was not yet her time to die, and so her higher self intervened. In 1/100th of a second, the higher self triggered a reaction in her adrenaline glands which, for a few seconds, provided enough strength to her muscles to enable her to execute the leap which saved her life. Adrenaline released into the blood can make it possible to flee from imminent danger, or to defeat the unbeatable, through anger or fear. In too strong a dose, however, adrenaline becomes a lethal poison. It isn't only the cerebral canal which is able to conduct messages between the higher self and the astral body. Another channel exists sometimes in dreams, or, I should even say, in sleep. At certain times during sleep, your higher self is able to call your astral body to itself and either communicate instructions or ideas, or to regenerate it in some way, replenishing its spiritual strength or enlightening it in regard to solutions to important problems. For this reason, it is essential your sleep is undisturbed by intrusive noise or by nightmares resulting from harmful impressions received during the day. Perhaps you will better understand the importance of your old French saying, "Night brings counsel." The physical body in which you exist at the moment is already very complex, but still, it is nothing compared with the complexity of the process of evolvement which occurs with astral bodies and higher selves. In order to allow ordinary people on your planet to understand as easily as possible, I will make my explanation in the simplest terms. Your astral body, which inhabits every normal human being, transfers to its higher self all the sensations that are experienced during a lifetime in a physical body. These sensations pass through the immense filter of 9 higher selves before arriving in the etheric ocean that surrounds the spirit. If these sensations are based essentially on materialism, the higher selves have enormous trouble filtering them, just as a water filter clogs quicker if it filters dirty water than if the water was already clear. If, through the numerous experiences you have in your life, you ensure your astral body benefits in a spiritual sense, it will acquire more and more spiritual understanding. In time, which can vary from 500 to even 15,000 of your earth years, your higher self will have nothing more to filter. This part of itself, embodied in the astral being of Michel de Marquette, will be so spiritually advanced, it will have arrived at the next stage where it will have to contend directly with the more superior higher self. We can compare this process with a 9-stage filter, intended to rid the water passing through, of 9 elements. At the end of stage 1 in the process, one will have been completely eliminated, with 8 remaining. Of course, to make this information easier to digest, I am making enormous use of imagery. This astral body then will have completed its cycle with the higher self of the first category and will then detach itself from higher self number 1 to rejoin the higher self of the second category. The entire process will be repeated. By the same token, the astral body will be sufficiently spiritually advanced to pass to a planet of the next category as well. I see you are not following me very well, and I am anxious that you will understand absolutely all that I explain to you. In his wisdom, the Spirit, by means of the fourth force, provided for 9 categories of planets. At present, you are on the planet Theuba, which is in the 9th category, that is, at the top of the scale. Earth is a planet of the first category and therefore at the bottom of the scale. What does this mean? The planet Earth could be likened to a kindergarten with the emphasis on teaching basic social values. A planet of the second category would then correspond with a primary school where further values are taught. In both schools, adult guidance is imperative. The third category would comprise secondary schools where a foundation of values allows exploration beyond. Next, you would go to university, where you are treated as an adult, for you would not only have attained a certain amount of knowledge, but you would also start to accept civic responsibility. This is the type of progress occurring with the 9 categories of planets. The more spiritually advanced you are, the more you will benefit, on a superior planet, by an environment and general way of life which is superior. The very way in which you procure food is much easier, which in turn, simplifies the process of organizing your way of life. The consequence is more effective spiritual development. On the higher planets, nature itself enters the stage to assist the pupil, and, by the time you reach planets of the 6th, 7th, 8th and 9th category, not only is your astral body highly evolved, your physical body has also benefited from your development. We know you have already been favorably impressed by what you have seen on our planet. As you see more, you will appreciate that it is what you would call on Earth, a paradise, and yet, compared with true happiness, when you become a pure spirit, it is still nothing. I must be careful not to make this explanation too long, for you must report it word for word, changing nothing in the book that you will write. It is absolutely essential you allow no personal opinion to intrude. No, don't get anxious. Thou will help you with the details when the time comes to start writing. From this planet, it is possible either to remain in a physical body or be reunited with the Great Spirit in the ether. As these words were uttered, the aura surrounding the leader shone more brightly than ever, and I was surprised to see him almost disappear in a golden mist, only to reappear a second later. You have understood that the astral body is a body which inhabits your physical body, recalling and noting all the understanding acquired during the course of its various lives. It can only be enriched spiritually, not materially. The physical body is merely a vehicle which, in most cases, we abandon when we die. I will elaborate, for I see that, in most cases, has confused you. By this, I mean that some of us, including all on our planet, are able to regenerate the cells of our bodies at will. Yes, you have already noticed that most of us seem to be of the same age. We are one of three planets that are the most highly evolved in this galaxy. Some of us can, and do, directly join what we call the Great Ether. So, on this particular planet, we have arrived at a stage near perfection, both materially and spiritually. But we have our roles to perform, as does every creature existing in the universe. In fact, everything, including a single pebble, has its role. Our role, as beings of a superior planet, is to guide, to help with spiritual development and even, sometimes, materially. We are in a position to give material assistance because we are technologically the most advanced people. Indeed, how could a father give spiritual guidance to his child if he were not older, more educated and more skilled in diplomacy than the child? If the child should require physical punishment, as unfortunately is sometimes the case, isn't it important that the parent be physically stronger than the child? Certain adults, who refuse to listen and who are absolutely stubborn, also need to be corrected by physical means. You, Michelle, come from the planet Earth, which is sometimes called the planet of sorrows. Indeed, the name is appropriate, but it is this way for a precise reason. It is intended to provide a learning environment of a quite specific kind. It is not because life there is so difficult that you have to intervene. You cannot lightly go against nature, destroying rather than conserving what the Creator has put at your disposal. That is, interfering with ecological systems, which have been intricately designed. Certain countries, like Australia, where you are from, are beginning to show great respect for ecology, and it is a step in the right direction. But even in that country, what case is made of pollution, both water and air pollution? What is ever done about one of the worst forms of pollution? Noise. I say worst because people such as Australians pay virtually no attention to it at all. Ask someone if traffic noise bothers him, and the response will surprise you. 85% of the time it will be, "What noise? What are you talking about? Oh, that noise, we get used to it." And it is precisely because they get used to it that the danger exists. Just then, Theora, as this high figure was called, made a gesture and I turned around. He was replying to a question I had mentally posed. How can he speak of percentages and know so much about our planet with so much precision? Turning around, I almost uttered a cry of surprise, for, behind me, stood Biostra and Latoli. In itself, this was nothing surprising, but the friends I knew who measured 310 and 280 centimeters in height respectively, were now reduced in size to correspond with my height. My mouth must have continued to gape, for Theora smiled. Can you understand that sometimes, and very often in these days, some of us live among your people on Earth? And there is my answer to your question. To continue on the very important subject of noise, it is such a danger that, if nothing is done, catastrophe is certain. Let us take the example of a discotheque. The people who expose themselves to music that is typically played three times too loudly are subjecting their brains and their physiological and astral bodies to vibrations which are so harmful. If they could see the damage that is caused, they would vacate the discotheque quicker than if there was a fire. But vibrations don't only come from noise, they also come from colors, and it is astonishing that, on your planet, experiments conducted in this field have not been followed up. Our agents reported a particular experiment involving a man who was capable of lifting a certain weight. It was found that, after staring for a moment at a pink-colored screen, he consistently lost 30% of his strength. Your civilization pays no attention to such experimentation. In fact, colors can enormously influence the behavior of human beings, and yet, control of this influence requires that an individual's aura be taken into account. If, for example, you want to paint or wallpaper your bedroom with the colors that are truly appropriate for you, you must be aware of the colors of certain principal points of your aura. By matching the colors of your walls with those of your aura, you can improve your health or maintain good health. Further, the vibrations emanating from these colors are essential for good mental balance, exerting their influence even while you sleep. I was wondering how we could be expected to know these significant colors in our auras when, on Earth, we were not capable of perceiving auras. Of course, Theora replied immediately, without me having to say a word aloud. Michelle, it is now very important that your experts invent the special equipment necessary to enable perception of the aura, as this, in turn, will ensure that correct choices are made at the critical crossroads ahead. The Russians have already photographed the aura. This is the beginning, but the results obtained allow them only to read the first two letters of the alphabet, as it were, in comparison with what we are able to decipher. The reading of the aura in order to heal the physical body is nothing compared with what such a reading can achieve for the psychic body or the physiological body. It is in the area of the psyche that, on Earth, your greatest problems exist. At the moment, most responsibility is taken for the physical body, but this is a serious mistake. If your psyche is poor, it will influence your physical appearance accordingly, but, regardless, your physical body will wear out and die one day, whereas your psyche, being part of your astral body, never dies. On the contrary, the more you cultivate your mind, the less you will be burdened by your physical body and the quicker you will proceed through your cycle of lives. We could have brought you to our planet in astral body, but instead, we have brought you here in physical body, and for an important reason. I see you already understand our reason. This pleases us, and we thank you for your willingness to assist us in our task. The Theora stopped talking and seemed to lapse into thought, at the same time, fixing me with his luminous eyes. I cannot say how much time elapsed. I know my state became more and more euphoric, and I was aware that the auras of the seven personages were gradually changing. The colors became more vivid in places, softer in others, while the outer edges became misty. This mist became more golden and pink as it spread, gradually blurring the seven figures. I felt Thao's hand on my shoulder. "No, you are not dreaming, Michelle. It's all quite real." She spoke very loudly and, as if to prove her point, she pinched my shoulder so hard, she left a bruise that could be seen for several weeks. "Why did you do that? I would not have thought you capable of such violence, Thao." "I'm sorry, Michelle, but sometimes strange means are employed. The Thaori always disappear, and sometimes appear in this manner, and you might have thought it part of a dream." I am entrusted with the task of ensuring that you recognize what is real. With these words, Thou pivoted me around and I followed her, as we departed by the same route we had come. The continent of Mu and Easter Island. Before leaving the Doko, Thou fitted a mask on my head, a mask that was different from the one I'd worn previously. I was able to see colors that were much more vivid and much more luminous. How do you feel in your new Vokimi shell? Do you find the light tolerable? Yes, it's fine, it's so beautiful and I feel so. With that, I collapsed at Thou's feet. She took me in her arms and carried me to the flying platform. I awoke in my doko, quite astonished. My shoulder was hurting. Quite instinctively I put my hand to the pain and grimaced. I am really sorry, Michelle, but it was necessary. There was just a hint of remorse in Thou's expression. What happened to me? Let's say that you fainted, although the word is not quite appropriate, rather, you were overwhelmed with beauty. Your new Voki allows 50% of the vibrations of color on our planet to pass, whereas your former Voki subdued all but 20%. Only 20%? That's incredible. All those marvelous colors I could see, the butterflies, the flowers, the trees, the ocean. No wonder I was overcome. I remember, during a journey I made from France to New Caledonia, we called in at the island of Tahiti. While there, I toured the island with family and friends, in a hired car. The islanders were delightful and made such a charming picture, with their straw hats constructed on the banks of lagoons amidst bougainvillea, hibiscus and azores, red, yellow, orange and purple, surrounded by well-kept lawns and shaded by coconut trees. The backdrop to these scenes was provided by the blue of the ocean. We spent all day touring the island and I described it in my journal as having been an entire day of inebriation for my eyes. I was, indeed, intoxicated by the beauty around me, and yet, now, I admit all that was nothing compared with the beauty here on your planet. Thou had listened to my description with marked interest, smiling all the while. She placed her hand on my forehead and said, "Rest now, Michelle. Later you will feel better and will be able to come with me." I fell asleep immediately and slept peacefully, without dreaming, I think for about 24 hours. When I awoke, I felt rested and refreshed. Thou was there, and Latoli and Biostra had joined her. They had regained their normal size and I commented on the fact straight away. "Little time is required for such a metamorphose, Michelle," explained Biostra, "but that is not important. Today we are going to show you something of our country and introduce you to some very interesting people." Latoli approached me and touched my shoulder with her fingertips, just where Thou had bruised me. Instantly, the pain vanished and I felt quivers of well-being run through my whole body. She returned my smile and handed me my new mask. I still found that, outside, I had to squint against the light. Thou gestured to me, indicating that I should climb on to the Lativoke as our flying platform was called. The others chose to fly independently, fluttering about our vehicle, as though playing a game, and no doubt they were. On this planet, the inhabitants seemed perpetually happy, the only ones I had found to be serious, in fact, even a little severe, despite their air of benevolence, were the seven Thauri. We flew at high speed, several meters above the water and, although my curiosity was constantly aroused, I often had to close my eyes to allow them to recover from the brightness. Still, it appeared I was going to become accustomed to it. I wondered how I would cope though, if it occurred to Thou to give me a mask which permitted 70% of the light to penetrate, or even more. We rapidly approached the coast of the mainland, where waves were breaking over rocks of green, black, orange and gold. The iridescence of the water, crashing against the rocks, under the perpendicular rays of a midday sun, created a memorably lovely effect. A band of light and color was formed, 100 times more crystalline than a rainbow on Earth. We rose to an altitude of about 200 meters and proceeded to travel over the continent. Thou flew us over a plain on which I could see animals of all sorts. Some were two-legged and resembled little ostriches. Others were four-legged creatures, similar to mammoths, but twice as big. I also watched cows graze side by side with hippopotamuses. The cows were so similar to those we have on Earth, I couldn't help but remark on it to Thou, pointing as I did so at a particular herd, just like an excited child at the zoo. She laughed heartily. Why shouldn't we have cows here, Michelle? Look over there and you'll see donkeys and there, giraffes, although they are somewhat taller than on Earth. See how lovely those horses are as they run together. I was thrilled, but wasn't I constantly thrilled by this experience, sometimes a little more, sometimes a little less? What really rendered me speechless, to the amusement of my friends, was the sight of horses bearing the heads of very pretty women, some blonde, others auburn or brown, and even some with blue hair. As they galloped, they would often soar for tens of meters. Ah yes, in fact, they had wings folded back against their bodies, which they made use of from time to time, something like the flying fish which follow or precede ships. They lifted their heads to see us and tried to rival the speed of the lativoque. Thou reduced speed and altitude, enabling us to approach within several meters of them. There were more surprises ahead of me, as some of these horsewomen cried out to us in a language that was recognizably human. My three companions answered in the same language, and the exchange was obviously a pleasant one. We didn't linger long at that low altitude, however, as some of the horsewomen soared to such heights, they almost touched our vehicle, thereby risking injury to themselves. The plain we flew over was, in places, embossed with small knolls, all of about the same size. I remarked on them and Biostra explained that, millions of years ago, these knolls had been volcanoes. The vegetation below us had none of the exuberance of the forest I had experienced on my arrival. On the contrary, here the trees were grouped in small stands, reaching no more than 25 meters in height. As we passed, large white birds took flight by the hundreds, only to land again, a safe distance away. A wide watercourse flowed to the horizon, dissecting the plain with its lazy wanderings. I could make out some small docos grouped together on a bend of the river. Thou guided the lativoque above the river, reducing altitude to water level as we approached the settlement. We landed in a small square between two docos and were immediately surrounded by the inhabitants. They didn't scramble or push to get near us, rather, they stopped what they were doing and calmly approached us. They formed a circle large enough to be comfortable and for all to have equal opportunity to see an alien face to face. Again, it struck me that these people all seemed to be of the same age, apart from about half a dozen that could have been older. Age, here, did not detract but added a quality of surprising nobility. I had also been struck by the absence of children on the planet, and yet, in this settlement and among the crowd that approached, I saw six or seven of them. They were charming and appeared to be quite level-headed for children. According to Thou, they would have been 8 or 9 years old. Since my arrival on Theuba, I had not yet had occasion to meet so great a number of these people. Glancing around the circle, I could appreciate a calmness and reserve about them, as well as the great beauty in their faces that I'd grown to expect. There was a strong resemblance between them, as if they were all brothers and sisters. And yet, isn't that our first impression when we encounter a group of blacks or Asians together? In fact, the same physical variety in facial features existed among these people, as exists within races on Earth. In height, they varied from 280 to 300 centimeters, their bodies being so well proportioned, they were a pleasure to behold. Neither too muscly nor too puny, and without deformity of any kind. Their hips were somewhat larger than you would expect in a man, but then I'd been told that some of them gave birth to children. All possessed magnificent heads of hair, most of a golden blonde color, others platinum blonde or coppery blonde and occasionally, a bright chestnut color. There were also some, like Thou and Beostra, with a fine down of hair on the upper lip, but, apart from this, these people had absolutely no other body hair. This is not, of course, an observation that I made at the time but one which I made later, when I had occasion to see from quite near, a group of naked sunbathers. Their skin type reminded me of Arab women who protect themselves from the sun. It was certainly not the pale skin typical of blondes with such light eyes. So light, indeed, were the mauve and blue eyes around me, that I might have wondered if they were blind, had I been on earth. When I speak now of their long legs and rounded thighs, they reminded me of our female long-distance runners, as well as their beautifully proportioned breasts, firm and shapely in every case. The reader will understand my error in believing Thou to be a female giant when first we met. It occurred to me that women on earth would be most envious of the breasts of these people, and men would be most delighted by them. I have already commented on the beauty of Thou's face, and others in this crowd had similar, classic, features, still others I would describe as charming or alluring. Each face, though slightly different in shape and features, seemed to have been designed by an artist. Each had been given its own unique charm, but, above all, the quality most evident in their faces and in their manner and deportment was the quality of intelligence. In all, I could find no fault with these people who grouped around us, beaming smiles of welcome which revealed rows of perfect white teeth. This physical perfection did not surprise me, since Thou had explained their ability to regenerate their body cells at will. There was no reason, therefore, that these magnificent bodies should age. Are we interrupting them in their work? I asked Beostra, who happened to be by my side. No, not really, she replied. Most of the people in this town are on vacation, it is also a place where people come to meditate. Three of the elders approached and Thou asked that I address them in French, and loudly enough for everyone to hear. I believe I said, I am very happy to be among you and to be able to admire your wonderful planet. You are fortunate people and I, myself, would like to live among you. This speech released a concert of exclamation, not only on account of the language, which most of them had never before heard spoken, but also for the sense of what I had said, which had been telepathically communicated. Beostra signaled we should follow the three elders, who led us into one of the dokos. When the seven of us were comfortably installed, Thou began, Michel, I would like to introduce you to Lachenuzi. She held her hand towards one of the three and I bowed. Lachenuzi was, about 14,000 of your years ago, the last king of the continent Mu on Earth. I don't understand. You don't want to understand, Michel, and, at this particular moment, you resemble many of your peers on Earth. I must have looked troubled, for Thou, Beostra and Latoli laughed loudly. Don't look like that, Michel. I just meant to jostle you a little. Now, in the presence of Lachenuzi, I am going to explain one of the mysteries that elude many experts on your planet, who, I might add, would do better to devote their precious time discovering more useful things. I am going to unveil not one, but several of the mysteries which obsess them. Our seats were arranged in a circle, Thou sat next to Lachenuzi and I sat facing them. As I already explained during our journey to Theuba, the Bacaritinians arrived on Earth 1,350,000 years ago. 30,000 years later came the terrible cataclysm that gouged out seas and caused the emergence of islands and even continents. I made mention also of an enormous continent which arose in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. This continent was called Lemur, but is better known to you as the continent of Mu. It emerged virtually in one piece, to be shattered 2,000 years later, by seismic shock, into three principal continents. With the passing of years, vegetation established on these continents, large areas of which were located in equatorial regions. Grass grew, forests established, and, gradually, animals migrated across the very narrow isthmus that bound Mu to North America. The yellow race that had better managed to come to terms with the disastrous consequences of the cataclysm were first to construct ships and explore the seas. About 300,000 Earth years ago, they landed on the northwest coast of Mu, where they eventually founded a small colony. This colony barely grew over the course of centuries as there were difficulties in expatriating, which would take too long to explain and which does not concern us now. About 250,000 Earth years ago, the inhabitants of planet Aremo X3, on which we stopped to take samples during our journey here, embarked on an interplanetary voyage of exploration penetrating your solar system. After having skirted Saturn, Jupiter, Mars and Mercury, they landed on the planet Earth in China, where their spacecraft caused considerable panic among the populace. Their legends refer to fire dragons descending from the sky. The fear and mistrust of the Chinese led them eventually to attack the aliens, who were forced to use violence in order to defend themselves. This they hated, for they were not only technologically advanced but also highly spiritual people who abhorred killing. They moved on, continuing their exploration of the planet. It turned out that the continent of Mu had most appeal for them for two main reasons. First, the continent appeared to be virtually uninhabited, and second, by virtue of its latitude, it was a veritable paradise. They had become particularly cautious since their confrontation with the Chinese and felt it would be wise to establish a base to which they could retreat, should they encounter further hostilities of a serious nature from Earth people. I have not yet explained that their reason for exploring Earth was their intention of resettling several million people from Aremo X3, a planet that was becoming uncomfortably overpopulated. This operation was much too serious to take risks of any kind. Thus, it was decided that their base of retreat would be set up, not on Earth, but on the Moon, which was quite close and considered very safe. 50 years were spent establishing the lunar bases, and it wasn't until they were ready that emigration to Mu began. All went well. The small Chinese colony that had existed in the northwest of Mu had been totally destroyed some decades after their first visit, so in effect, they had the entire continent to themselves. Work began immediately on the construction of towns, canals and roads, which they paved with immense flagstones. Their usual means of transport was a flying chariot, not unlike our Lativoks. From their planet, they imported animals such as the dog and the armadillo, which they were very partial to on Aremo X3, and also the pig. When she told me about all those imported animals, I remembered how astonished I'd been to see pigs and dogs on that famous planet during our earlier visit. Suddenly, everything was very clear to me. In height, these people averaged 180 centimeters for the males, and 160 centimeters for the females. Their hair was dark, their eyes of a beautiful black, and their skin lightly bronzed. You saw some of their kind when we stopped at Aremo X3, and I believe you have already guessed them to be the ancestors of the Polynesians. So they established settlements throughout the length and breadth of the continent, including 19 large cities, 7 of which were sacred. Small villages were also numerous, for these people were highly skilled farmers and graziers. Their political system was modeled on that of Aremo X3. They had long ago discovered that the only way to govern a country properly was to place at the head of government seven men of integrity, representing no political party, but sincerely committed to doing what they could for their nation. The seventh among them was the supreme judge, whose vote on council was worth two. If four were against him and two with him on a particular issue, they were at deadlock, and hours or days of debate would ensue, until at least one of the seven was persuaded to change his vote. This debate was conducted within a context of intelligence, love, and concern for the people. These high figures received no great material benefits for leading the nation. It was their vocation to lead, and they did it for the love of serving their country. This avoided the problem of hiding opportunists among the leaders. The same can't be said of our national leaders now, I remarked with a hint of bitterness. Where were such men found? The procedure was as follows. In a village or district, a man of integrity was elected by referendum. No one with a record of bad conduct or a tendency towards fanaticism could be chosen. The chosen one would have demonstrated integrity in all spheres. He would then be sent to the nearest town, along with other representatives from neighboring villages, and there, further elections would be held. For example, if there were 60 villages, there would be 60 men elected by the people for their integrity and not for promises which they made, but couldn't keep. Representatives from all over the nation would meet together in the capital city. They would be divided into groups of six, and each group assigned a particular conference room. For the next 10 days, the group would be together, holding discussions, sharing meals, enjoying shows, and, eventually, they would elect a group leader. So, if there had been 60 representatives, divided into 10 groups, there would be 10 group leaders. Of these 10, 7 would be elected by the same process, and from the 7, an eventual supreme leader would emerge. He was given the title of king. So, he was a Republican king, I said. Thou smiled at my remark, and Leishanuzi gave a slight frown. The king was elected in this way only if his predecessor died without having nominated a successor, or if the successor was not unanimously accepted by the Council of Seven. He was given the title of king, first because he was the representative on earth of the Great Spirit, and second because 9 times out of 10, he would be the son or near relative of the preceding king. Something like the Roman method, then. Yes, indeed. However, if this king manifested the slightest tendency towards dictatorship, he was overthrown by his council of peers. But let's go back now to our emigrants from Aremo X3. Their capital city, given the name Savanasa, was situated on a plateau overlooking the Gulf of Suvatu. The plateau was 300 meters high and, except for two hills, one in the southwest and one in the southeast, this was the highest point on the continent of Mu. I'm sorry, Thou, may I interrupt? When you explained the cataclysm which knocked the Earth off its axis, you said that refuge on the moon was not possible because it didn't exist, and yet now, you say that safety bases were established on the moon for these emigrants. There was no moon at the time when the blacks populated Australia, or for a very long time afterwards. There had been two very small moons much earlier, about 6 million years ago, which revolved around Earth, eventually colliding with it. Earth was not inhabited at the time, so, although terrible cataclysms followed, it didn't really matter. About 500,000 years ago, Earth captured a much larger moon, the one which exists now. It was passing too close to your planet and was attracted into an orbit. This often happens with moons. Further catastrophes were provoked by this event. What do you mean when you say, passing too close to Earth?
Well, we'll have to wait till next week to find out what that was all about.
I am Barry. It's been the Voice Within. Kakite. Shalom. Namaste. Masala. May your God go with you.
This Free FM podcast was brought to you with support from New Zealand On Air.